It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
Last week, Davidson talked about finding your story. This week, I'd like to share some thoughts about finding mine. It's sometimes difficult to find your story. I think it's complicated by the fact that parents naturally try to give their stories to their children. One story I grew up with, and the one I think might be my mother's main story, although I don't know if she'd put it in these terms, is one you're probably familiar with. It's the story of a woman in a man's world, the story of a woman succeeding in a profession that is overwhelmingly male. Essentially, it's the story of the women's movement. For me, my mother was the heroine in this story. She's a computer science professor with a doctorate in mathematics, both fields that were and are heavily dominated by men. And at first, I tried to take her story as my own. I even got as far as a master's degree in computer science. But her story didn't work for me. The world I've experienced is nothing like the one my mother experienced 40 years ago. I don't remember ever being on the receiving end of overt sexism. And when I tried to succeed as a woman in a male-dominated field, I failed, not because of sexism, but because I had no passion inside of me for it. At some point, I realized that I was still in school because of the odd notion that I somehow had an obligation to women to succeed at it. One of the earliest stories I remember being taken with was the life of Joan of Arc. My mother, I think, liked this story. After all, it's the story of a woman who succeeds in one of the most male-dominated times in history. And on top of that, she succeeds at one of the most male-dominated aspects of society, making war and nation-building. I heard a very different theme in the same story, though. The part of the story that sang to me was always about the voices that she heard. The part about trusting and completely giving herself over to something larger and bigger than herself. I say voices, although I don't mean for that to sound spooky. What really resonated with me was the notion that there was something internal that only I could hear that told me what was true and right. And the idea that if I could only act on what I knew to be true in my heart of hearts, I could make miracles happen. One of the stories I read about Joan described a dark time in prison when she, both publicly and privately, denied her voices and became seriously ill. She didn't recover until she realized that she had denied something that was very precious, very sacred, and very real. I rarely think of her triumphant, leading armies of French to defeat the English. Rather, I think of her learning how to trust herself to know that she was right, even while confronted by the external power of the clergyman she was facing in her trial. The Joan of Arc in my head is the one in prison, first struggling with and then accepting her internal voices. In a previous affirmation of faith about religious creeds, I confessed that I didn't yet know what drove me to do things each and every day, and that I thought that that meant I hadn't yet figured out what my real creed was. Maybe stories are a better answer than creeds. This one certainly drives me.
Of our service and our lives, let us take time to honor life's quieter dimensions. We use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. For our prayer this morning, I want to recapture some of the prayers of ancient Greeks to three of the female figures that they created as goddesses. They began with six gods and six goddesses in the Greek Olympiad, and then they added another goddess. They added Persephone, the daughter, so they wound up really with seven women in the group. This is a prayer to only three of them. We'll talk about three of the others or four of the others in 2 weeks. This is a prayer to Persephone, the daughter, Demeter, the mother, and Hera, the wife. They're simple prayers. But hear what simple human things they're praying for. Persephone, help me to stay open and receptive. Demeter. Teach me to be patient and generous. Help me to be a good mother. Hera. Help me to make a commitment and be faithful. Let us claim those petitions as our own. Help us to stay open and receptive. Help us to be patient and generous and to be good mothers. Help us to make a commitment and be faithful. Help us reclaim these gentle parts of ourselves that we might become more whole. Amen. Blood bringing in a prayer to the goddesses of wife, mother, and daughter. It wouldn't be odd if this were Hyde Park Baptist Church. But it is odd in the Unitarian Church. After the first service this morning, a woman came through the line to tell me she had been a Unitarian for 50 years. That she went to college in the 50s, got her MRS, got married, had children, and absolutely loved being a mother. It was the most fulfilling thing in her life. And she said for 20 years she was reviled in sermons and coffee talk at her Unitarian churches for choosing motherhood. All of you who were in Unitarian churches in the 60s and 70s will remember this. It wasn't rare. The reason this is because Unitarian culture got identified in the 60s with the culture of political liberalism rather than religious liberalism. And it got identified with the biases of the women's movement, which were good, but not enough. I think politics makes horrible religion. It's far too small. And so I want to try to work today and in 2 weeks and in some other weeks too to expand the horizons of what we're seeing to find a religious center rather than a political one again. So I'm trying to do something unlikely this morning, which is to bring back a deeper awareness of some of the dynamics, the goddess figures, the ways of being women that are welcome in conservative churches and have not felt as welcome in liberal churches for probably 4 decades on this. To do this, I've used the Greek myths of wife, mother, and daughter, or at least mentioned them, but that isn't going to sway a lot of Unitarians who want hard facts and science. That's the myth of Unitarians. So I've decided to do this by bringing you hard science instead and bring you some biological studies that show why 3,000 years ago the Greeks might have thought that these tendencies were so profound and eternal that they deserved to be made into goddesses. Now, if you're my age, you have seen America grow through 2 very different phases of the goddesses, to put it that way, that influenced women. Not only different, but diametrically opposed. If you grew up when I did, you grew up when the goddesses of wife, mother, and daughter were the dominant roles prescribed for women in America. This was the age of Ozzie and Harriet, Father Knows Best, and the Donna Reed Show. And how extreme was this? Here's your factoid for the morning. Every sermon should have one factoid. I don't know where I read that. If I find it, I'll tell you. It'll be another factoid. After World War II, when these were the 3 goddesses that were absolutely dominant in prescribing women's roles, women went to college to get their MRS degree. Many of us remember that. After which they would often drop out of college because the point had been marriage, not an education. After all, they were women, as it would have been said in the 50s. In 1950, here's the factoid, the birth rate in the United States equaled, for the only time in our history, the birth rate in India. That's what it looks like when those are the goddesses who dominate the roles for women. Very powerful stuff. Now, if you grew up when Jonaby grew up, instead, you grew up in a very different America. And very different goddesses were prescribing roles for women. And in fact, they were the ones who revolted against the roles for women when I grew up. These were the goddesses of the women's movement, at least one goddess. We'll talk about them in 2 weeks. They were very different. When you talk about bringing science into a church, it's always interesting for me when you talk about biology, because by the biological studies that I've read, done by the same scientists using the same methods, generally like to deal with two aspects of sexuality, sexual orientation, homosexuality, and the difference between males and females, the hardwired differences that preclude and come before choice. Now, you can bring scientific studies on homosexuality into liberal churches anytime you want, because they say that sexual orientations are pre-wired in our brains before we're born. This fits the biases of liberal politics, which endorse individual choices and freedom. And you can bring the results of biological scientific studies of the differences between men and women into any conservative church that you want, because they endorse the conservative roles for women. I don't think you can bring the results of all of it into any church without irritating people. So that's what I want to do this morning. It's a short irritation. And I've done a lot of reading in this. It's a subject like animal behavior and comparative animal behavior that I've been interested in 30 years. I want to just bring you some of these things and then bring it back to talk about why the Greeks would have thought 3,000 years ago, because things haven't changed in human nature all that much, why they would have thought these are so powerful and eternal that they deserve to be called goddesses, and how that might change how we see women, so that we don't have, and I don't think we do today, we don't have women 30 years from now going through a line telling a minister, I spent 20 years in a Unitarian church being reviled for the lifestyle I chose as a woman. That should never happen here or anywhere else. Let's talk about a little bit of biology. I'll have the footnotes in the version that goes on the web if you want to prepare for the test. I'm not going to quote them here. Biology says that there are ways of being that we cannot choose, that choose for us. And they choose for us because if we choose against them, it doesn't feel right to us. It doesn't feel natural to us. My favorite line in Jonaby's affirmation of faith was the one where she said that when the reason that she failed in competing in a man's world was not because of sexism. It was because she had no passion for it. That's another way of saying it didn't feel natural to her. It's another way of saying these aren't the goddesses she's serving. And it's another way of saying she could not choose to take the road of competition without losing herself. And that's never worth doing, losing ourselves. The differences between boys and girls are apparent after the first hour of birth, in case any of us were wondering if boys and girls are different. Girl babies are much more interested than boys in people and in faces. The boys seem just as happy with an object dangled in front of them. I was thinking about this week when I was standing for 5 hours in front of my wood lathe. And I thought, this has absolutely nothing to do with me. From the outset of life, girl babies show a greater interest in communicating with other people. What I want you to think about as these pile up is, how would you describe the kind of person that's developing here, and what kinds of things in life would they seem naturally equipped for? I want you to think like conservatives for a while. Boy, will that be uncomfortable. One study involves babies of only 2 to 4 days old. Shows that girls spend almost twice as long as boys maintaining eye contact with a silent adult And girls also look longer than boys when the adult is talking. The boy's attention span was the same whether the adult was talking or not, showing a relative bias toward what they could see rather than what whatever that thing is saying. This female bias toward the personal shows itself in other ways. At 4 months old, most baby girls can distinguish photographs of people they know from photographs of strangers. Boys can't. A one-week-old baby girl can distinguish a baby's cry from a background of general noise of a similar volume. Boys can't or don't care to. Boys will make up stories full of zap, pow, and villainy. Girls' narratives are more apt to focus on home, friendship, relationships, and emotions. The boy may tell the story of a robber, while the girl may tell the same story from the point of the victim. Now, of course, we all remember from the playground boys and girls who didn't fit these patterns. And the point is, we remember them because they didn't fit the patterns. The patterns were the broad background against which a few exceptions really stand out. But all the innate differences, and this is a very short list, as you know too, add up to is what poets and regular people have been saying forever and ever and ever. Men and women are different. Women are the gender with a higher awareness of and sensitivity to the existence and needs of other people. They come wired to care about the needs of their children. Both biologists and religious conservatives say that it is very significant that there is no known culture in which child rearing is done mostly by men, or war is done mostly by women. And these weren't choices, they say. This is who we are. This recognition that females have a role that seems to equip them naturally as nurturers and caretakers, and this was almost heresy in Unitarian churches to say this 30 years ago and 20 years ago. It's amazing. It describes females of every species we know, including our own. Someone after the first service was scrambling to find exceptions, and the two exceptions they found, and there are exceptions to everything. There are probably even exceptions to the rule that there are exceptions to everything, but I don't know those exceptions. The two exceptions they found were seahorses and cowbirds. You got to do better than that. Even in mammals, it's hard to think of significant exceptions, and the rule might be more important than the exceptions. So when religious or political conservatives fight for laws that define and defend women's roles as mothers and wives, when they oppose abortion as violating a natural law so deep and ancient that it should be considered the voice of gods or God, they're standing on solid ground. It isn't the only solid ground, but it's solid. Is this irritating yet? I was so upset. A woman came through after the second service and said she wasn't at all irritated. But I think she'd turned her hearing aid off. I was reminded during all this stuff, and was reminded when Jonaby talked about not having passion for doing what women in the women's movement of 30 years ago thought it was the duty of every woman to do. I liked it when Jonaby said she realized somewhere in here she was doing this because she thought she had some kind of an obligation to women to succeed. I remember this from 30 years ago, and those of you who were around then remember it too, I'm sure. And I was reminded of this paragraph by a Canadian psychologist named Sandra Whittleson. To have power like riches or lovers, she says, one has to want it, work for it, and strive to maintain it. Men will make the most extraordinary sacrifices of personal happiness, health, time, friendships, and relationships in the pursuit and maintenance of power, status, and success. Women won't. Most of them simply are not made that way. Made that way means something that precedes choice, something that determines what choices feel right or wrong, and so they limit what can be chosen. This sounds so silly to say this out loud. Even at the simple chemical level, this is for the engineers among you, males and females are profoundly different, and the differences influence and direct behaviors. Estrogen, for instance, has a neutralizing effect on what some call the aggression hormone, testosterone. Several clinical studies have showed how estrogen can rescue violent males from extremes of aggressive behavior. It's even been used to control the behavior of male sex offenders to some extent. And another woman scientist wrote, this is one where married women will sit there and say, yep, that's right. And married men will say, that's not right. See what you think. Marriages work against all the odds, not because women are submissive and accommodate their domineering males. Marriages work because women's natural social skills, it's been called social intelligence, enable them to manage a relationship so much better than a man. I've planted shills in the audience. Women can predict and understand human behavior better than men, can sense the motives behind speech and behavior. So if he's the engine of the ship, she is the rudder, but she is also the navigator because she alone has the chart and knows where the rocks are. Notice there's no hint of inferiority in that woman's description of women, just profound difference. But it's a very different notion than the one that circulated in liberal cultures in America in the 60s and 70s of sensitivity training to make men more like women. Biology's message is there are limits to this, and the limits are much more profound than we want to recognize. That's almost exactly what the Greeks were saying when they called these things gods. They said there are tendencies so powerful you cannot choose not to honor some of them without dishonoring yourself. And that's the feeling of being on a path for which you have no passion, in which you're there to succeed for other people at the cost of yourself. It's not a path worth taking. How would understanding this view of women change the way we look at women today? Older women in our churches grew up when I did in the women's movement under very aggressive and assertive feminine styles, which are important parts of a whole and insufficient as a whole. Younger women have grown up now where they can say that they've never experienced overt sexism, and they choose a path because they have passion for it, which happens to fit some stereotypes of women more than others. 30 years ago, they would be told by some of the feminist writing, and some of you will remember who said this, and I cannot remember which one it was, the woman who wrote in the 70s that if women want to have children, they should be persuaded not to. That was the bias of 30 years ago. It's changed a lot. Liberal culture has to change, and I think that liberal religion needs to find a liberal religious center, not a political center, and to get past the ideology of social liberals and political liberals. In 2 weeks, I'll continue this when we consider the other kind of goddesses, the powerful ones. But I'll warn you, there's a bad surprise coming. And that's that of the three uppity goddesses, and we think of the women's movement as the rise of the uppity goddesses, we really only thought of one of the three in the 70s. And if we'd known our Greek mythology better, we would have known what the other two were and which one was going to win. Because the most powerful goddess in Greek mythology is firmly in the camp of conservatives. Her manifestation in the 1970s was as Phyllis Schlafly. The Greeks knew her as Athena. I've tried to be irritating, but I have tried very hard not to be the kind of irritation that just causes blisters. I want it instead to be the kind of irritation that acts like a grain of sand acts in an oyster. When accommodating it and adjusting to it and incorporating it can finally produce a pearl.